Hello and welcome to Witchy Wellness Radio. I'm your host, Lauren Chalantani, women's holistic health coach and fellow recovering perfectionist. This podcast was created to show you that your body is not in the way. It is actually leading your way. Hello, hello, and welcome back to Witchy Wellness again. This is your host, Lauren. And you're listening to episode 66, Food is Medicine with Jennifer Menard. And I'm so excited to bring you guys yet another beautiful episode with a gorgeous and juicy topic with our guest, Jennifer. She worked in the biotech and pharmaceutical medicine areas for over 20 years. And putting that passion into what she does today, she thought she could better use her expertise using food as medicine. And she created her own, co-founded her own company, Nutrition for Longevity, which is a farm-to-fork meal kitting company that focuses on nutritionally tailored meals to the masses direct from her farm. And we talk more about this in the episode. And if you are interested in anything that Nutrition for Longevity offers, make sure you use the code WITCHY for 10% off your order. Again, that is code WITCHY, W-I-T-C-H-Y, for 10% off your order on Nutrition for Longevity. I love it. I've been using their coffee, their olive oil, which comes from a couple hundred-year-old olive trees in Italy. They offer way more than just the normal meal kits, which are also amazing, fresh from the earth, organic, beautiful meals. But more on today's episode. We go into things like that olive oil and how to actually eat as if you are in a blue zone and what a blue zone actually is, as well as the longevity diet. And the person she co-founded her company with created and researched longevity diet, and they co-founded Dr. Longo and her Nutrition for Longevity, which is the meal kit service. We also talk about the soil, why it's so important, and how using regenerative soil practices not only can change the earth, but can change our own microbiome and own health. And how farming in our soil has drastically changed, not for the better, since World War II. We talk all about Nutrition for Longevity, which we spoke of earlier, a farm-to-fork meal-knitting company. We also talk about food spending and healthcare spending and what you can do about it today. And the surprising truths about the farm industry today and big pharma, how you can take control of your health by what you put into your body and what to look for and how to eat, but most importantly, how to eat for longevity and not just for another fat diet. And I really, really recommend the book that her co-founder, Dr. Longo, wrote, The Longevity Diet, if you are looking into how to bring in lifestyle changes into your life that make you feel better, and not only feel better now, but for a longer period. And we all want to live a long life, but we want to live it well, full of passion and full of love and full of health. And if you guys are interested in their meal kitting service, which is Nutrition for Longevity, which I have used and I love, make sure you use the code WITCHY for 10% off your order. I'm so excited to have this beautiful opportunity for all of you guys to test out these beautiful things you can add into your lifestyle, you can add into your diet that actually help with your longevity now and for the long run. So without further ado, please enjoy this another amazing episode, number 66, Food is Medicine with Jennifer Menard. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Witchy Wellness Radio. And today we have Jennifer Menard on the show, and we are talking about nutrition for longevity. This is going to be an information-packed but powerful episode. Welcome to the show today.
Thank you for having me. Very excited.
Me too. Like we were talking off air, this could go multiple ways, but I would of course love to dig into all of it. But a little bit about you before we get in for the listeners. After putting 2 decades of her passion into changing people's lives through medicine, modern medicine, she felt her knowledge and experience would be better served focusing as food as medicine. Jennifer has worked in the biotech and pharmaceutical specialty medicine areas for over 20 years. Even though progress has been made with medicine, the battle with chronic illness is being lost. In order to address this, she founded Greater Greens, a regenerative organic farm, as the first step to bringing this movement to the front and center and to help focus on the root of our health challenges. Once the farm was fully operational, she co-founded Nutrition for Longevity, a farm-to-fork meal-making company that focuses on bringing nutritionally tailored meals to masses direct from her farm. That's amazing. We have so many places to go, but tell us how you got into this transition from this like Western medicine. I love hearing people's backstories because it interested me so much.
Yeah.
Into this holistic, like, I love how you said root cause of things and how you are actually dealing with the plants and their roots. And we all know it's the environment's very important to that nutrition.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
If you could, I'm sure it's longer than what we have here. Just dive
I'll
in.
I'll try to keep it short. I mean, I think where I'm at now took me a little bit back to my roots. So I grew up in Alaska on a homestead, and we grew most of our own food. We kind of lived off the land. And so I've always been very fond of nature and very connected with nature. And my mother used a lot of holistic medicine and herbal medicine. And so I grew up that way. I grew up with very healthy food, always in the ground, growing things and connecting with my food. And then as I went to school, well, when I was younger, I lost my uncle to AIDS, and that was in the 80s, and it was really challenging. Like, he really suffered, and I felt like we're nowhere near where we need to be with modern medicine. And I just felt like at that point, the healthcare industry kind of failed him, because to see someone suffer, and I was fairly young, it was just really hard, and I couldn't do anything about it, and that frustrated me. So I moved into specialty medicine to try to have an impact in that space, and I worked in HIV/AIDS, and then I worked in hemophilia and oncology and ophthalmology. And you know, I think there is a huge need for advancements in modern medicine, like the area of hemophilia. Unfortunately, it's a genetic disorder, and you can't take herbal medicine. You know, you're missing a clotting factor. And I worked on a treatment that enabled them to move away from plasma fractionation, which usually pulls like 30 people's plasma. Very complicated process, a lot of risk to it. So that those kinds of medications, I believe, are absolutely necessary. And I was really passionate working in that space. But as I moved up to like an executive level, you end up in a much broader role, and you look at the industry as a whole, and you know, what kind of impact are we making? And I just felt like we were spending 90%, and I mean the whole healthcare industry, not just pharma companies, but how we handle medicine in the Western world. We spend 90% of it focusing on the pill or the injection and treating a symptom and not the illness and the underlying root causes of that, and only about 10% on the holistic side. And it was almost even comical because I went to like herbal medicine classes for like 2 years, and the team or the groups that I would go to herbal medicine class were like, "You work for these horrible companies, you know, you're pharma evil." And then I'd tell people at work, and they'd be like, "You work with these voodoo people." And I was like, "When are we ever going to bring these two things together and understand that both have a place?" But I feel like we need to flip it. 90% should be focused on the food and the holistic way of doing things, which is lower cost, because our current healthcare will bankrupt our company, or sorry, our country, if we can't start making changes. It's just not sustainable in any way from a financial standpoint. And then if you look, it just continues to skyrocket. We're not making progress with chronic illness. It just continues to rise. So obviously, it's a bit backwards. So I think we need to flip that. You know, 10% should be in treating these really, critical conditions that don't like you can't take herbal medicine. You can't just cure it with food. You really have to be on some sort of treatment or prophylaxis treatment or something. So that's what drew me to kind of food as medicine. Is I feel like it's one of the most fundamental things that we should be focusing on. And if we look at 80% of chronic illness is related to lifestyle, and nutrition is one of the easiest ways we could affect that. I just felt like we're missing this massive opportunity. And, you know, I know a lot of organic farmers and they're just struggling. They don't necessarily have the business experience to get their farms off the ground. So I thought, okay, let me start there. Let me try to help that industry move along and bring healthy food to, you know, in a productive way, in enough volume that we could actually feed the world with a farming model that actually works. And then how do we get them? And then the meal kit company came second, but it was always part of the strategy of how do we get that to people in an easy way that they can have the right macronutrient mixes without having to think about it. Because there's so much misinformation out there, and I think people are just very confused. So I wanted to make sure we could produce healthy food and then we could provide it to people with guidance. And our meal kits kind of scale. We are actually launching just a produce box for people that actually really feel like they got their bearings with food and they know what macros they need. And then we have like meal kits that are that people still have to cook it, but it's all in the exact quantities they need with cooking instructions. And then pretty soon we're going to move to ready-made as well. So that we give people kind of different options based on their lifestyle and what they need guidance on. And we focus really heavy on the education piece as well. But yeah, I mean, I was an executive working in the pharma industry, living in Switzerland with my family. And I basically just decided, I want to make this change. I had always planned on doing it. And I just was like, I'm fast tracking it. I quit my job and bought a farm. And that was a big change. But it's where my passion is. And, you know, I've never looked back. I've never regretted that decision. I'm really excited about where we're taking this industry, and not just the farming and how we can produce healthy food, but also how do we create these interventions of food as medicine, where we can really start helping human health in a cost-effective way. You know, it always is mind-boggling to me that we spend more than any country in the world on medicine, but we're only the 34th healthiest country, and we spend the least amount of food per capita than any country in the world. So we're off on something there, right? So, and living in Europe, I lived in Switzerland for 3 years and Germany for 3 years. It also gives you a different perspective on how different the food model really can be. With fresh food readily available to you, and not with all the preservatives and additives and things like that. So when you are immersed in an environment like that, it makes you hyper aware of the sugar, the additives, the preservatives, because that's mainly not included in the grocery stores there. It's like 3/4 of the grocery store is produce and nothing processed. And then there's this little sliver that's processed food. Ours is pretty much the opposite. So those things all kind of just drove me and came together and got me to where I am now.
Beautiful. One of my friends, my local friend and chiropractor, he is really big about nutrition. And one of the quotes he always says, I don't know if some other quote, but America is overfed, but undernourished.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they say, I think 1 in 3 people that enters a hospital is malnourished, but also we have more than that in the population that are overweight and obese. So we're definitely malnourished, yet we have a weight problem. So that's obviously counterintuitive, but something we need to start addressing. So, yeah.
For sure. And, you know, I think my perspective of how healthcare is in this country, but kind of worldwide more so in this country absolutely. I mean, I know that we need emergency medicine. I am thankful for that. And I know you said people who need these pharmaceutical drugs for these genetic conditions that you can't really solve via nutrition. Yeah. But it's the mindset of it all, like you said, is not looking at the root cause of the issue. It's there's no proactive or preventative care.
Yeah.
And And that I love how you view that with nutrition and with what you put into your body. Well, how are you fueling yourself? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the quality of food you eat, the supplements. And even for me, it's, you know, what quality of thoughts am I thinking? But that's a whole nother topic.
Yeah.
The stress level. Yeah. But because you dive into, you know, the environment, like soil is so important.
Yeah.
And the nutrition and really the state, people don't even realize the state of our world's agriculture and the soil that it's in right now than it was 50 to 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Boggles my mind.
Yeah, it definitely does. Yeah. And that's why, I mean, that's definitely why I started with the farming first, because I do think it's the root of a lot of our challenges, because even people that try to eat healthy, they're just not sure where to go. And I think the environmental aspect of it is huge. You know, the United Nations has looked at meta studies, thousands of studies, and has shown that agriculture is the least costly, most effective way for us to reverse climate change. You know, if we converted all of our electricity to solar power, they're saying it would take 100 years to start reversing climate change. If we converted 30% of the world farms to regenerative organic farming practices, we could start reversing it within a few years. And that's pretty dramatic. I mean, our soil is this huge carbon reservoir. We've lost 2/3 of the carbon out of our soil, and now it's atmospheric carbon. So you got to look at soil as this huge sponge that is actually waiting to suck that back in. And if you really take care of your soil and you build up soil organic matter, there's plenty of studies now showing that that is the best way that we can start capturing carbon back into the soil. So, I mean, that's one way or one reason I'm very excited about the farming, is we can have this incredible environmental impact. But then also, for every 1% of soil organic matter, we can save on water. 170,000 gallons per acre water can be saved with water retention, because again, it's like a sponge with water as well, and you build up this incredible soil structure. And then if you look at it from the nutrient side, you have these this produce that you're growing that, you know, we used to be in the U.S., like you said, 50 so years ago, only 30 years ago, you know, we were closer to 11% of our soil organic matter. We're now down to about 1% on average across the U.S. And again, that's meant to be that sponge, this incredible matrix that can pull in the carbon and the water and then be this exchange of nutrients. But it's almost non-existent. And so using regenerative farming practices, we can start to build that back up. And we've also lost a lot of our biodiversity of the soil microbiome. So we have monocropping. We use lots of chemicals in our modern agriculture. We use tillage. All those things are definitely known to disrupt the soil microbiome. And then, of course, you don't have organic matter, which is the matrix that it survives in. So we need to do a lot to start to reverse that. What's incredible is it actually doesn't take that long. You can start to do that within just a few years, really start having a dramatic impact. But it takes effort. It takes a change in the way we do things. You know, a lot of people I talk to are like, well, it seems so obvious. You can get better yields. You can use less water. Why is everyone not doing it? But if you look at the history of farming in the U.S. and you really start to deeply understand that, you definitely understand the behaviors as well. Like, most people don't know the number one suicide profession in the U.S. is actually farmers. Most people would never expect that. Like, they think, how hard could it be to sit on a tractor? But it's, you know, typically generational farmers that do not want to be the generation that loses the family farm. And they're the most debt that they've been in for 20, 30 years. Literally, I think the average is now $1.1 million of debt for the average farmer. This is a lot of debt. I mean, if you look at your mortgage, people are usually worried about a couple hundred thousand. But there's this extreme fear of losing the farm. So if you put that in perspective, they don't want to take any risk. They don't want to even try to do organic farming, which is really hard the first few years because you're fighting getting an ecosystem back into balance. And anyone that's tried to do that, even if it's on a small scale, their garden, or even if it's your gut microbiome or any sort of biome, to hit equilibrium can be really painful. Like, you have to definitely give it time and you got to put a lot of work into it. So again, a farm that's already at risk of losing the farm and heavily in debt, they're not going to want to take that risk. And so it's going to take a lot of behavioral change, policy change, things to start supporting farmers. I'm excited about some of the trends with carbon credits, because that's a way that farmers can be paid for doing the right thing with regenerative farming. And I think those types of things are starting to create some momentum where we're seeing more and more farms starting to move in this direction. And consumers are starting to ask for it. If you look at big chain grocery stores, more and more are having organic food, regenerative food. And then that fuels, you know, conversion and bigger, even consumer brands starting to support that as well. And so we have this critical momentum, and it's really exciting to be part of that. Because it's absolutely essential for the nourishment of our soil, which then provides healthy food to feed our bodies. Yeah. So.
Yeah. I think like I used to be very, and I'm mostly plant-based now, but I'm not, I don't consider myself any which thing. It's whatever my body intuitively needs, which I support for everybody. Don't guilt yourself over what you're eating. Yeah. But I remember reading like the number one reason for deforestation, especially in like South America, mm-hmm. is farming. And a lot of time agricultural, you know, livestock, but also, you know, these huge, ginormous, like big corporation farms as well. Mm-hmm. And I don't think people realize like how the industry of farming has changed too. Yeah. We talked about the soil, but how before, you know, you wouldn't be able to buy things that were out of season or that were tropical fruits up north. Yeah. And now it's like, it really boggles my mind with the food industry. And even if you are buying organic, and maybe you can talk more about this.
Yeah.
Like in Ohio where I live, there's like a 50-mile thing and a 30-mile thing where people like to source locally. Yeah. And that's great to see that happen. But could you talk to us about that, the big farming industry? Yeah. When we talk about big pharma, we're talking about big farming.
I mean, it's definitely, you know, I've done some talks just on the history of farming because I think it's a really fascinating journey. And then a lot of things start to make sense of what's happened in farming. So that's a long lecture in itself, but I can kind of give you the short version. So I think what's important, like you said, you talked about deforestation, which I think is really can be very devastating because instead of reversing climate change, we're even further, you know, damaging it. I think what's important to understand is that 80% of our agriculture is focused on meat production. So I'm also, I don't like all the labels with vegan, vegetarian. I really preach reducitarian because like even my husband, he hates when I use him as an example, but I'm going to. When we met, every meal had to have a slab of meat or he didn't consider it a meal. Like if it was just a salad, that was like a snack. He's like, that's not a meal. He's now mainly plant-based, and that was a big change that took 20 years. But I really encourage people, like, you know, you can start to take your meat down, and not only can it be good for your health, but it can have incredible environmental impacts. And that's actually why I became mainly plant-based. It actually wasn't initially about health. It was about how can I support the environment better? And knowing that 80% of farmland is for meat production, I thought that just doesn't make any sense. And it's hard to get certain vegetables. And that's because so few farmers are actually producing like your typical vegetables. Most of the farms in the US are producing five crops. They're mainly monocrops, it's mainly grains, and it's mainly for meat production. So I think that's important to put into perspective. And it does start with the history of farming. If you go back to the Great Depression, which is the most pivotal change that impacted our farming, you know, there was real fear and real starvation happening. So the government took over the entire agriculture industry. It's the only sector still to this day that's mainly controlled by the government. And they started subsidizing a lot of the grain products, meat production, dairy production. And they wanted a lot of inexpensive food that they could get to the market with a long shelf life because there was this fear of starvation and we got to store stuff longer. So that's when a lot of your preservatives and additives came. That's when Wonder Bread, you know, the super white bread came with ultra preservatives and it's fortified with all these nutrients. So your kids aren't going to be malnourished. And that's when milk started getting fortified and pasteurized. And everything was about how do we produce as much as possible for as cheap as possible and have it last as long as possible. So if you look at that time, that's when we were gifted all these incredible things like creamy peanut butter, white bread, fortified dairy. That's when we got American cheese, you know, all these incredible gifts for our nutrition, right? But that's really what started that movement. And it hasn't changed that much since then. In fact, it's probably even proliferated further. And if you look at also how the subsidy structures were set up and crop insurance and things like that, it's very hard to be a biodiverse farm. Our farm produces hundreds of different varieties, but it's complicated and you can't rely on most of the structure that supports agriculture. And as I mentioned, farms also have gone more and more in debt. They're very reliant on their seed suppliers. They're very reliant on government funding. If they have a crop failure, they have crop insurance. They don't want to take any risk beyond that. So you haven't seen a big shift. And then in the 50s, you had the introduction of massive equipment on a large scale, and then a lot of chemicals. You know, in the 40s, we started realizing we have a lot of chemicals left after World War II. We could use these as nitrogen fertilizer. A lot of different things, because our soil already back then was pretty depleted. So we already were really suffering, and the solution was put chemicals on it. And so we put all these band-aids on, and we never really addressed the root cause. And only today are we starting to really address the root cause, you know. So the soil health is actually very similar to human health. We got to do a lot of work to build, like, I really am amazed the more I learn about the soil microbiome, how similar it is to our gut microbiome. And I'd love to talk about that a little bit as well. But yeah, this history of farming is just, you also had the wars, the World War I and World War II had an incredible effect on farming and urbanization. So you had people moving into the cities after the world wars. The younger gentlemen would come back, or nurses or whatever, and they wanted to live the city life and live it up when they were younger. They didn't want to go back and take over the family farm because it was hard work. So they were exposed to different things, and so they go back to the city. And what's incredible is we colonized the U.S. around our most fertile land. That's where we could grow the best food. As cities sprawled, we actually covered the most fertile land, and we pushed the farmers out to the least fertile land, and then we abused it. So we have had this issue kind of from almost day one in the way we colonized. So we have more and more issues with soil fertility, and our practices continue to make it worse. And then we had urbanization, and what happened with that is you started having this centralization of farms, where bigger and bigger farms started to emerge, and then you had these massive farms with massive monocrops. Mechanization, which allowed you to just do these monocrops with extreme efficiency, with mechanization, with these huge machines, agriculture equipment. And now it's even automated. So you don't even need bodies in these tractors. They just kind of run themselves. So that's, I think, what's kind of moved into this mega farms and monocrops and automation, which we kind of consider a movement forward in agriculture. They actually called it the green revolution. And I find it ironic because I think it's far from green. and I think now we're looking at deconstructing a lot of that and actually realizing even the USDA is the first to admit that tillage is probably the most destructive thing that was ever introduced to agriculture. Yet for 50 years, it was touted as the savior of our agriculture system. So we're starting to learn more about soil microbiome. We're starting to realize that most of our farming practices are extremely destructive, and we need to kind of go back. And if we innovate, we need to do it in ways that are constructive, not, you know, destructive to the earth. So yeah, a lot on agriculture. I could go on, but I'll stop there.
Oh, you're fine. Well, I do want to hear more about what you said about the microbiome of the soil. Yes. And our bodies, because I am interested in that for sure.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think, you know, when I look at the soil microbiome, especially the rhizosphere microbiome, which is the root base of a plant, it's very much like the gut microbiome. And that's where a lot of the studies came from, is the Human Genome Project started researching our own human DNA plus our holobiome. And if you haven't ever heard that concept, or your audience hasn't, it's the collective RNA and DNA of your whole system, which includes at least 50% of cells that are not your own human cells. So that's viruses, bacteria, in the soil, it's nematodes, worms, all of those things. they're more than 50% non-human or non-plant. And what the holobiome looks at is all of that as collective RNA and DNA that your system can actually pull from. It's this symbiotic relationship. And if you keep it in balance, it's going to keep you healthy. Well, the soil microbiome or the rhizosphere microbiome is very similar. And it's really sophisticated. And we only understand a very, very small amount of it. But even what we understand is extremely fascinating. And that is that part of a plant's holobiome is passed down from generation to generation in their seed. So you literally can have hundreds of thousands of years of heritage DNA that's passed down that a plant can draw from that has knowledge built into that plant. And we look at that holistic RNA and DNA as biodiversity also for that plant to pull from. So just as an example, I like to use the example of if there's a drought, it actually can pull from its own reservoir of knowledge from its soil microbiome to say, how do I respond to this? And it can also recruit from the soil microbes that it needs to be able to respond to that. So if you look at that biodiversity, it is essentially the plant's stress coping mechanism. It's its immune system. So if a drought is coming or it starts feeling that there's less water, it can actually tell the plant to change at a genetic level. And that's what I think is very new, even for the gut microbiome, is that these organisms are not just, you know, doing a few things at like a high level metabolic level, but actually it's changing the way we express our DNA and the plant as well. So it can tell the plant, you can change your, or you should change your entire root system. You should send out deeper roots, more lateral roots, finer root fibers, anything that you can do as a plant to survive this drought. And that collective RNA and DNA is what's doing that. And I find that incredible that also our farming practices have been working against the plants because we're damaging that microbiome. And it's where it's the total stress coping mechanism of the plant. So in order to allow a plant to really cope with stress in a productive way, you need that healthy soil microbiome. And what happens is that you have this incredible exchange of nutrients. So the plant is able to actually pull nutrients out of the soil because those organisms are facilitating that. And in exchange, guess what's happening? Carbon is coming out of the atmosphere into the soil. So you have that carbon sequestration cycle happening. And then the other exciting thing is when a plant is stressed, they're also encouraging it to create phytonutrients or phytochemicals, which are the chemicals that plants produce that are helping it cope with stress. They're what a lot of the pigment of different plants are. We like to call those phytonutrients. So like purple plants, for example, have a lot of anthocyanidins or anthocyanidins, maybe quercetin or resveratrol. A lot of these are now being investigated for triggering our longevity genes. So they actually also send our body in a stress coping mechanism. So they do that for the plant, but also when we consume them as humans, we're realizing they're triggering a lot of those same things. Not every phytochemical is healthy for the body. Obviously, there's plants that are poisonous for that reason, but we know a lot of plants that are also very healthy for that reason. And that's why I also encourage people, just like a plant needs a diverse soil microbiome, you should be eating a diverse diet as well. I say eat the rainbow because every color is representing a different spectrum of phytonutrients. And those are being, again, created by the plants to cope with stress. That's why they say organic or different types of farming practices, the plants can produce up to 30% more micronutrients or these phytonutrients because they are stressed. You know, you're not spraying them with chemicals. The plant is having to defend itself. So then you get this incredibly nutrient-rich food, you get this fiber, and then it's feeding our gut microbiome. We're completely connected to these plants or should be connected to these plants. And, you know, I like to also tell the story, like our primitive brain and the way we used to respond to stress, actually, you have a narrowed spectrum even in your vision. And that used to tell you, you would see these more vivid colors much more, or you'd see these bright colors more vividly, like purples and reds, because your body needed those to cope with stress. So it actually used to connect you to that. We've lost that pretty much over the years where we have almost no connection to food. We don't know what it's supposed to smell like anymore because we have all the artificial smells. We have artificial flavors. We have artificial colors. We have preservatives. We have additives. We have wax. So we've lost this natural connection to food to where our bodies don't really know what we need anymore. Just like a plant selects some of its microbiome to cope with stress, our bodies used to do that as well. So I always also encourage people, start connecting with your food. Try to, even if you can grow like a tomato plant on your porch, like get your hands dirty in the soil, touch that food, smell it. I mean, if you even touch a tomato plant, the aroma is so stimulating in a really good way. I mean, unless you hate tomatoes, but most people don't. or herbs in your windowsill. It's so important that we start reconnecting. Even when I went to herbal school, you know, they were always like, you'll find your herbs or they'll find you because you connect with those plants, and your body does inherently know what it needs to balance itself out. So those are just some of the things I think are very important for everyone to understand, that the soil microbiome is extremely important. It absolutely affects the health of the plants, and it absolutely affects then what that food does in our human body. And if we're eating clean food, we're also not damaging our gut microbiome. Just like the soil microbiome is damaged by a lot of those things, so is your gut microbiome. It's very sensitive, and we don't usually look at our overall system and take care of our system. You know, everyone's like, oh my gosh, more than 50% of my cells are non-human. That's gross. And I'm like, well, actually, it's this incredible system that's working together, and we never take care of it. We're stressing it out. We're feeding it junk food. We're just dousing it with chemicals. And so I really like people to look at their body as this really sophisticated system that they need to focus on keeping in balance.
Yeah. And the tagline for this show is, your body is not in the way, it's leading your way.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's exactly with food too. For me, I started my health and wellness journey through food, and now I've gotten way more spiritual on that path, but food was opportunity, just taking the time, like you said, your senses to smell the food, even if you're not growing it, to taste it. And I remember one week I challenged myself to every piece of food that I had in my mouth to chew it at least 20 to 30 times.
Yeah.
It's Which ridiculous.
Almost seems painful. Yeah. It almost seems painful when you do it, but yeah.
I was like, is this how many times you're supposed to chew? Because I'm like, there's no way.
Even the start of, you know, I've talked to a lot of doctors that are big advocates in the holistic space, and they'll say you should wait 5 minutes before you eat your food as well, and allow your salivary glands smell the food, because that's all pre-digestion. And we usually are just wolfing down our food, or we're taking it on the go. And they actually said that's really a bad habit. We need to almost make eating a ritual. You know, it's okay if on occasion you do that, but at least like dinner, you know, sit down. If you look at longevity regions, it's fascinating because they sip on tea, they really make it this ritual, and they kind of set that time of the day aside. This is my food. I'm going to kind of decompress. I'm going to eat this food, and then I'm going to do my other stuff. And they separate it out. And I feel like everything with us is just intertwined. We're on our phones, we're overstimulated, and we never slow down and absorb that food and connect with the food. So no, I think it's so critical.
Yeah. And I think, you know, on my own journey, it's like not one diet, and you're not supposed to stick to one strict diet. Yeah. And like you said, going for that beautiful rainbow of that microbiome of foods. And once you start tuning into your senses more, you realize you actually crave certain foods in that, in that respect. Like before my menstrual cycle, I crave beets all the time, and I don't eat red meat. So I'm assuming that's why, is like the higher iron probably. I don't know.
Absolutely.
Minerals. But it's really interesting once you get into that, because I mean, I quit sugar for probably like 2 years. I mean, I eat it very, very minimally now.
But
that turned my taste buds upside down.
Absolutely. That was what was incredible for me living in Germany and Switzerland, is when I first moved there, I went to this bakery, and I mean, there's bakeries everywhere, and the stuff just looks incredible. And I was like, oh my gosh. And so I remember getting this like pastry that looked so decadent, and I ate it, and I was like, that was the blandest thing I've ever eaten. Like, it looked incredible. And it's funny because then you, there's just way less sugar and additives and preservatives. So you really taste the food. But at first it's shocking because you're, and I don't even eat a lot of sugar, and it was still that shocking to me. And then I remember moving back, or even when I would come to visit, I would have something that I expected to be bland here, and it would be so intense. Like, I was like, how did I ever eat that before? And I could even taste the chemicals in food, because you become, again, your body gets sensitized to it again, and you do start tasting everything. Like, even our meals, we don't have any added sugar, and we don't have a lot of salt and fat. You know, all three of those are very addictive things, and they're just so much a part of our Western society diet. I mean, we consume more protein than we need, 50 grams a day on average, more protein than we need. We consume 50 grams on average of more added sugar. That's a lot of sugar. That's 58 pounds of sugar a year per American. And what's crazy with the longevity diet is we know both of those things trigger aging genes. So we're actually accelerating our chronic illness by over consuming these different things. And protein's very important. I'm not saying it's not important, but it's important to get the right protein and the right quantity, that you're not overdoing it. And fruits and vegetables, 1 in 10 people in America eats enough fruits and vegetables. Like, that's incredible, because we have access to it almost everywhere. I mean, of course there's areas of food insecurity and that needs to be addressed, but in general, we have access to produce year round, like you said, 24/7, and we're just not consuming it. And it's the one, it's probably been studied more than anything else in food, is the connection to the reduced risk of chronic illness is just diets high in fruits, vegetables, and fiber. It doesn't mean you can't eat meat. It just means you need more of that in your diet. And it's still so rare to meet somebody that consumes enough. And that's even just the 5 a day. That's not even, if you look at longevity regions, it's closer to 10 a day. Those people are consuming the majority of their diet is plant-based. And it, you know, it's, I tell people, if they say, they're like, oh, but it's so complicated, I don't know how to do it. And I said, well, just start reversing the way you think about things. When you go into a restaurant, what do? You order an entree, which is usually a big slab of meat. And then they ask you what sides you want, which are usually not even a full serving of fruits and vegetables. It's like these tiny little sides. And I just tell people, just flip that, right? Your entree should be the fruits and vegetables, and the protein should be the small portions on there. Like, it should be the side dish. So I think we have a lot of things just quantity and proportion wise just very much off, and we need better non-biased kind of education out there of, you know, not just trying to push people to buy these different products that we kind of know are unhealthy, but how do we educate people and give them the right balance of these foods?
Amazing. I would love to go deeper into, like, you know, you co-founded Nutrition for Longevity. What does that mean? What do you guys do?
Yeah.
Got a little bit that last, but I would love to hear more about that.
Yeah. So what I focused on, I actually co-founded Nutrition for Longevity with a company called El Nutra. And the founder of that company is Dr. Walter Longo, who's basically one of the forefront or leading scientists behind the study of aging or longevity. So he's kind of reversed the perspective of, you know, the theory of aging and that we're aging and there's nothing we can do about it. And he said, well, there's actually a lot we can do about it. And he's really researching what we can do about it. And what he's found is that feeding and fasting are two of the biggest things we can do to or slow down aging, essentially. And more than anything, expand our health span or increase our health span, which is the healthy part of your life where you live this vibrant life, you have great cognitive ability. And essentially it's slowing down the chronic illness or eliminating chronic illness in our bodies. And what he did is he designed the longevity diet. Like we give that book for people that call and are interested. So I can give you a link if people are interested. It has different recipes on how to eat, and it gives the whole history and all the science behind it. And what I found was fascinating is he started with areas of the world where they already understood it. They just inherently had passed it down generation to generation and they got it. And then he said, well, let's understand the science behind it. What exactly is working? But he started with these areas that clearly understood it already. So they fasted, all of them had some regimen of fasting, and all of them had very similar macronutrients. It was mainly plant-based. They ate a lot of legumes as their source of protein. They ate in a very different way, though. So they, most of them follow a circadian rhythm fast, which sounds very scary to a lot of people, but it basically just means you let your body get in a cycle. Essentially, you stop eating. You could look at it even that you follow the sun cycle. When the sun goes down, you stop eating. When it comes back up, you eat again. I just follow it as a 12-12 because sometimes I wake up before the sun. And what I do is I stop eating 3 to 4 hours before I go to bed. And that allows my body to start to slow down the digestion process, the early digestion process, and move into cellular regeneration. So a lot of times, because food is so available all the time, we never allow our bodies to have that decompression. So what we have is this, the circadian rhythm is basically you have cortisol throughout the day, and you actually want a healthy cortisol level. You want that to have a peak where you have your energy and you can be active and you can exercise and you can have great cognitive ability, but you want that to come back down and you want your melatonin to start coming up so you can get a deep sleep. And when we throw that off and we eat too late, you're throwing off that cycle. Your cortisol is staying up longer. Your melatonin is taking longer to go up. So it does impact your sleep rhythms. It actually has been now linked to chronic illness because we're not allowing our body to go into that deep sleep, which triggers also cellular regeneration. So that's when our body essentially, I mean, people call it different things, but I call it kind of detoxing naturally. That's when all our organs are saying, okay, these cells are too damaged. We're going to clean those out of our system. And these cells we can repair, and then we need to create new cells. And it's just a refresh of the body. It's literally happening every day. And then Long has also done research on prolonged fasting, which is if you really want to have that cellular regeneration, you need to fast for about 3 days. And he's created fasting mimicking diets that allow people to still consume a certain level of food that's very controlled. That's called Prolon, is the one they have on the market, which allows you to do essentially the equivalent of a 5-day water fast and boost your cellular regeneration. And a lot of that's in his book. Again, we can put the link. Your audience can have the book for free because we love to share that knowledge. And he really explains the science behind it and what's really going on behind that and the anti-aging genes. And then, like I said, things like sugar and protein that actually accelerate your aging genes. So it's all about how do we eat the right foods that actually trigger anti-aging genes, like certain phytonutrients. Quercetin's been heavily studied. Resveratrol's been heavily studied. Anthocyanins. So what are these foods that we know are really good for our bodies? And what are the foods we should minimize? Like you said, everything's about balance, but that we know trigger the aging genes. And so that's what our meal kits are kind of founded on, is what are those right macronutrients? We try to make it simple for people so they don't have to track their macros every day. For people, like I said, that do already know that and they feel like they're in a good rhythm, we do just provide healthy, clean food. And they can have their own diet the way they want it. And again, we try not to be too restrictive, even though we offer a vegan variety and pescatarian. Those are our only two offerings. We also, like, if people call and they're like, look, I'm never going to be a vegan, we're like, we get it. It's okay. You know, practice reducetarian. Start taking meat down to a smaller amount, like cut out 1 or 2 days a week that you're not going to eat meat. And here's what you can do instead. And I think a lot of people are surprised that it's not nearly as painful as they think. Like, beans can actually be really good if they're cooked right. And pasta and these different things that we've kind of taken out of our diet can be really nutritious. And if they're consumed in, again, the right balance, they can be very satisfying as well. So that's kind of what's behind our diet, is these, I do the feeding side of things. How do we eat and when do we eat? And then El Nutra, who's my business partner, they do the fasting side of things, which is these regimens on how do you do a safe fast at home, and you don't have all the side effects of a water fast, because only like 1% of people can make it through a 5-day water fast. I know, I'm a pretty tough person. Yeah. I know I can't do it.
I know I can't do it. I've done juicing fast. Yeah. For 5.5 days was my longest. I haven't done one in years.
Yeah.
But
I'm really impressed with people. People are like, they'll be like, well, you should just do a water fast. I was like, if you can do that, you are awesome. But most people can't. So Longo's big thing is like, almost every major civilization has had some form of fasting, whether it's religious based. And again, I think these are inherent things that were passed down for generations that people just adopted and they realized it made them feel really good. But it was also maybe part of a religious holiday or something like that. And we've lost that kind of in the US. And so he is trying to really revive that and show that there's these incredible health benefits, which is why it lasted for so long. And only until very recently, most people don't do it anymore. So like I do a prolonged fast every 3 months. I basically do it quarterly because I feel amazing when I do it. So again, a lot of that's in the book. I'm kind of a geeky person. I love to see the science behind it because I just find it fascinating. So you don't have to read all that stuff, but I think most people just are so excited to see that it's a real thing. Like, you know, a lot of herbal medicine, I absolutely believe in it, but there's less science behind some of it. So it gets scrutinized. So he's starting to really show that, you know, these things are real and they're activating different genes. And like I said, I think a lot of people are surprised that these things are affecting us at a genetic level. We usually just thought, oh, it makes me feel good. Well, there's a reason behind it. That's actually changing the way you express your DNA. We're realizing chronic illness. We always thought, well, I'm predisposed because of my genetics. I can't do anything about it. And they're actually saying 80% can be controlled because we can actually change the way we express our DNA. And I think that's amazing. I think it's actually very, what I love about his research is it's really positive because it shows there is a way that we can control a lot of these things within our life and not just be at the mercy of our genetics and have to just be on medication. I'm not saying that, like I said, I worked in the area of hemophilia. It's a really challenging disease because there's really not a lot that can be done. But on the other, like I said, 80%, we can control it. And there's a lot we can do with food and lifestyle.
Amazing. Yeah. The study, the research of epigenetics, we've had people on and talk about that before. Oh. We're running out of time here, folks, but like everything in the show notes is just, it's amazing. It's powerful to be able to know that the food you put into your body, but also, you know, metaphysically, the thoughts emotionally also affect it in different ways. It's powerful. And that all contributes to that longevity factor.
Absolutely.
Which is amazing. One last question before we wrap up. Okay. So your meal kits, is that available for everybody in the US? I just want to make sure people are listening. Yes. Where, how can you ship and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so it's available in the continental US. Okay. We can't unfortunately ship to Hawaii. But it's available in the continental US. We're actually expanding our farms right now as well, regionally. So we're really excited about that. We've created kind of this, we call it a micro farm, but it's a modular farm that essentially we can replicate in different regions. We grow slightly different crops and obviously the calendar is different in every region, but we're really excited for that. So we do, again, for the continental US, we can provide that. And as I mentioned, we actually in a week are going to launch produce boxes, which just have our produce from our farm. And then we have meal kits that have breakfast and lunch that are basically ready to eat or with very, very minimal work behind them. And then dinner, which is a meal kit. It's already pre-portioned with instructions to cook it in less than 30 minutes. And then in about a month and a half, we're going to launch ready-made meals. And that's just to really try to accommodate for every lifestyle need. People that don't want to cook at all, they have something that they can just pop in the oven and it's not going to take too long. For people that actually enjoy a little bit of cooking but need a little bit of guidance, they have that meal kit. And then people that are like, I got this, like one of my friends that works in the company, I didn't know at first, and she sent me a picture of one of her meals and I was like, oh my gosh, you're like an artist, the microgreens are perfect. And she's like, yeah, my husband's an executive chef, so they don't need my help. They just want the clean produce. And so we kind of give those different levels for people. And we even have people that'll order the meal kit just once a month to just kind of train their body, like how to, like you said, you start to crave these things, like this is how I should be eating. And then it just kind of educates them so they can stay on track the rest of the month. So there's a lot of different things people can do to, again, fit their lifestyle. We just really want people to be eating healthier. We want them to look at food as prevention, but also like we're also trying to take it to the next level that we don't just look at food as prevention, but we look at it as your first intervention for illness as well. That 80% that we can control, we want people to definitely control that. So anything we can do, and even we encourage people, you know, the longevity diet book, like I said, if people are interested in your audience, we'll get that to them. There's even recipes in there. He gives, you know, we don't try to keep this super secret. It's all in there. So you don't have to buy our meal kits. And, you know, that's important for Dr. Longo. We want to spread this knowledge. So it just depends what kind of help you need. We have dietitians on staff that can give guidance, and that's part of the service as well. If you buy a meal kit, you get access to the dietitians. So we have every level. You don't have to buy anything. You can have the book and work on that, or you can have these different cascading levels. But we just want people eating healthy and taking care of their bodies and changing the way we look at farming and changing the way we look at human health and using food as a key aspect of that.
Amazing. That's so empowering. It just it's a no-brainer. You know, people are always like, oh, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to eat healthy. Yeah. No excuses, people. There are beautiful companies and brands and people like yourself that are here to help make it easy at any amount that you need of help, little to a lot. So if you guys are interested, we'll have all of this in the show notes and including that longevity diet book as well, mm-hmm. which I know I'm going to get my hands on. That's amazing.
It's a great book. It's, you'll learn so much. I mean, it's like mind blowing. I read it like once a year and it takes me like a month and a half because I'm like, oh my gosh, I got to think about this. So it's great.
Well, thank you, Jennifer, for coming on the show today. And we love to close the show with, you know, thank you so much for coming on and taking the time and not only showing up for us, but for yourself and taking this huge leap. Awesome. And to showing up for something that you're so passionate about that helps so many people. And we would love to return that favor as an act of gratitude for you in return. So how can we be of service for you today?
Okay. So thank you for having me. I love your passion and your knowledge that you share with your audience. So I appreciate being on the show. I think one thing I would ask is, like I mentioned earlier in the show, I think it's really important that people connect with nature. And so I challenge people, if they can, to grow one of two things. Either grow yourself some herbs or tomatoes. Even if you live in an apartment, you don't have any space outside to grow a little pot of herbs just to get your hands a little dirty, just to connect with that and smell those herbs. It's so important to start being part of that process and appreciating it and letting your body reconnect with your food. Or plant a perennial. And the reason I encourage that is perennials are so important for adding back biodiversity for our native pollinators and our soil microbiome. So perennials come back every year. They usually have incredible root systems. They create this incredible environment for the soil microbiome. But they also usually provide a native habitat. I encourage you to get a perennial that's native to your area. Our pollinators are, our insects as a whole, the biomass of insects in the last 20 years is down 80%. I mean, if you look at the food cycle and the cycle of life, it's actually really frightening and most people don't know it. So if you could either plant or both, plant some sort of vegetable or herb, outdoors or indoors, just connect with it, do it in soil, or a perennial where you can be supporting a native species or multiple native, literally you're helping tens of thousands of species underground and potentially hundreds above ground. You can contribute to the environment, you can contribute to your own human health. I think it's just an easy step that people can take that will transform so many different things. So that would be my ask. Do it for yourself, do it for the environment. I love to spread that because I think it's one simple thing that we can all do that has actually a dramatic effect on the world.
Oh yeah, for sure. Worldwide. Yeah. Those are beautiful examples. I know starting an herb garden on our little windowsill on our apartment. That was my goal for this summer. It's like, I'm doing something, even if it's small, get my hands in the dirt. I love gardening. Absolutely. It's just like connecting
It's therapeutic. I mean, they're actually doing studies that just even soil microorganisms can impact our, like directly impact our brain. I mean, we know our gut microbiome can, like 90% of our serotonin is created in our gut by our gut microbiome. But even the soil microbiome in itself, they've directly connected to like PTSD. There's incredible studies going on. So even just getting your hands dirty can be really good.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. That is amazing. Thank you so much today for coming on the show again. I learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners will too.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
And remember, open up, surrender, trust, and let your body lead the way.